Good morning, good people. I'm Kiplin Primus, your host for The Local Take. And this week, I reached out to Professor Douglas A. Blackman about his seminal book, Slavery by Another Name, The Reenslavement of Black Americans from the Civil War to World War II. This book was released in 2008 and awarded the Pulitzer Prize. A documentary was created by Public Broadcasting, which broadcast in 2012. If you're not familiar with either of these, I encourage you to take in this content to have a better understanding of what is going on today. Douglas Blackman is a former writer at the Wall Street Journal and currently a professor at Georgia State University. Mr. Blackman, welcome to The Local Take.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Well, my first question, honestly, is what was the impetus for you to write this book on our nation's history?
Well, as a writer, all through my career, I had always been drawn to stories and realities that explored, in particular, the intersection of racial history and the mistreatment of African Americans in American history, the intersection between all of those abuses and commerce, businesses, and the economy, and the way that economic circumstances were oftentimes a giant force behind some of the most terrible things that were done. But I think one of the reasons that I always had an interest in those things was because I grew up in a little cotton town in the Mississippi Delta, in a place where there were more black people than white. And I was in the first class of children in Mississippi to begin the first day of first grade in fully integrated classes and go all 12 grades. Black and white kids together in the same schools, the same classrooms. And even as a child, I was very aware, I didn't really understand all these things, but I was just very aware that there were far more obstacles in the path of my black schoolmates than there were in front of me and my white classmates. And from a very early age, I was sort of gripped by the question of why was that? It just didn't make sense to me. And so I've ended up spending a good part of my life trying to answer that question.
And one of the things that the book talks about was, it was slavery by another name, and it was basically the prison industrial complex where states were able to enslave black men, black children for anything, you know, loitering, looking at a white person the wrong way, anything, any reason, and then they leased those prisoners out to do not only work for the state, but work for private industry. And it seems like that's exactly what's still going on today. Is it the same?
Well, it's the same in some respects. It's also different in some important respects. But the fundamentals of it and the legal ability of the government, both the local government and state government, to engage in the practice of allowing prisoners to be rented, in a sense, to do work in private factory settings or call centers that are set up inside prisons, and those kinds of commercial activities, the legal basis for that is the same as the rationalization that was put forward 125 years ago, and that is the exception in the 13th Amendment, which is the amendment passed after the Civil War to abolish slavery forever, but as people these days are much more familiar with than they were not that long ago, there is an exception to the 13th Amendment, which allows for involuntary servitude as punishment for a crime. The problem is that it's allowed only for punishment of people duly convicted, quote-unquote, people who have actually committed a crime and been appropriately and properly convicted in a court. And certainly 125 years ago, there were vast numbers of people of of African-American men and some African-American women, and a much smaller number of whites as well. But vast numbers of people were being forced into this kind of involuntary servitude on the basis of crimes which had never occurred or that they had not committed or things that were really not crimes at all, the things that had done no harm in any meaningful way to society.
Now, that to me was the start of this systemic and institutional racism. What do you say to people who don't believe systemic and institutional racism exists in our country?
Well, what I would say to people who don't believe that there's such a thing as systemic racism or implicit bias or structural racism, any of those terms that are used, anyone who says that those things simply don't exist, like the governor of Mississippi recently said publicly, essentially said that, and any others, what I would say to that is that they are either terribly, terribly ignorant or delusional. There's really no other way to say it. And it's also a deliberate effort to misunderstand or to pretend that they misunderstand what is actually meant by those words. Obviously, there's no doubt about the reality, and science has proven it, and personal experiences prove it, that implicit bias, this reality that people have instinctive reactions that they may not even know, consciously know why they are having these reactions, but that they react differently to people who look one way from people who look another way. Those are things that have been absolutely scientifically proven. What is going on in much of the denial of the existence of things like structural racism, it's an effort to try to conflate racism and hatred. And while racial hatred is obviously a part and has been a part of the reality of race relations and racial abuses, they are not the same thing. And a person can in fact consciously believe the things that we would hope that they would believe. A person can say that, no, I completely accept the equality of all people, and I have no animosity toward anyone. I certainly wouldn't want to harm anyone because of their race. A person can genuinely say those things and believe those things and still have instinctive reactions based on the conditioning of their lives or their upbringing or the society that they live in that, in fact, result in discriminatory, sometimes terribly discriminatory treatment of African Americans or some other racial group.
Now, it seems that to me, looking at the history of our country, it almost seems that we're caught in a loop. Progress for African Americans or other oppressed people start to make progress, and then oppression, the hammer comes down on those people. And I remember during the Obama administration when things were, seeming to get so crazy about having a black man serve as president of the country, that there was going to be a result that was going to be harsh for people who look like me. And that happened. Trump was the backlash to Obama. Reconstruction started. We had African American citizens serving in Congress, serving in the government, and then you had the flashback or
the backlash
to that being Jim Crow ruling in the southern states. How do we get out of this loop, or can we get out of this loop? Do we ever get out of this loop?
Well, I think that I completely agree with and understand and sympathize with the sense of frustration and far more than frustration, exasperation, sense of betrayal that the cycle you describe leaves not just African Americans but leaves all people of goodwill who are trying to see our society advance, but obviously is most terrible and most difficult or African Americans or any other group that might be oppressed in similar ways. But at the same time that I sympathize with that and I see it and agree with it in many ways, I don't think that the loop is completely symmetrical. You know, it's not Groundhog Day. We're not making progress and then going all the way back to where we started on that progress. And I do think it's important to remember that we have made tremendous advances in our society over the past 50 years and the past 100 years, and certainly over the past 150 years. So we are making progress. I think it's even better progress than two steps forward, one step back. Maybe it's three steps forward, one step back. And I think that's what Dr. King was telling us when he made reference to the arc of the moral universe, and that ultimately it bends toward justice. And the reality, as I see it, is that if we can see the arc of justice from afar, it clearly is moving not as fast as we would wish, but it clearly is bending toward justice. But the closer we get to it, and when we look at the most recent events that we've experienced, then we really can see that it doesn't go in one direction. You know, it bounces all over the place, and sometimes it reverses course for a period of time. And we certainly are in a moment like that where the backlash against progress that has been made, and frankly, just the degree to which that there were a lot of white Americans, even some who voted for President Obama, who were caught up in the sense of optimism and progress that his campaign brought out during the campaign season in 2008. And there were huge numbers of people who were drawn to that, including some who would have voted Republican typically or would have called themselves conservatives and who felt good about what was happening. But then when they woke up one morning and saw that there was an African-American man in the White House, that was something that triggered them in a way that, I mean, the ultimate kind of structural or instinctive or implicit bias, implicit discrimination. And I think that you're exactly right, that the recognition that something as momentous as that had occurred was something that triggered this enormous negative reaction. I think part of what that also speaks to is that even with the more optimistic things that I've just said, we do live in a society that was molded in white supremacy. Our society was born of white supremacy. And white supremacy, the belief that it's natural for things to turn out best and most profitable and most successful for white people, and that it's normal for things to go not nearly as well and probably badly for black people, that basic set of expectations rooted in white supremacy, if that goes back to the very beginnings of our society, it's baked into our founding documents, and it is so much a part of our social DNA, our cultural DNA, that almost every American, perhaps every single American, no matter what their race, is infected in some way with the virus of those notions of white supremacy. The question is not really whether we've been touched by it or whether we carry it somehow within us. The question is, how do we respond to it? Do we recognize it when it appears? Do we beat it off? Do we help other people beat it off? That those are really the questions. Do we wear a mask as we should, you know, to stop spreading the virus of white supremacy? And I think that the way that we make more progress is by staying vigilant and continuing to believe that there are people of good faith, there are people of goodwill of every color. And while right now we're seeing far too many people acting in bad faith and cynicism and banality and power grabbing, that nonetheless, the justice is going to prevail.
I certainly hope so. Now, you know, one of the things going on, part of that backlash that we're talking about, is the voter suppression laws that are happening across the country, with our state, Georgia, being the leader. And while many people are still talking about the water restriction, the law calls for a partisan board of advisors that have the power to overturn the votes in any county. This isn't democracy. You know, how did democracy become outdated to people in our nation when our nation is supposed to be the beacon of democracy?
Well, I think what we're seeing right now, and you're exactly right, that the provision of the Georgia law that allows for the state election board appointed by the legislature and over which the Secretary of State no longer has any authority and doesn't even get to vote, but the existence of this election board and the fact that it will now have the power to declare that some particular jurisdiction has had so many problems with an election that they're going to suspend the local election officials and put in place someone of their choosing. You know, that is far and away the most dangerous and deliberately disruptive and destructive, unpredictable thing in the entire law. Absolutely no doubt about it. The other things that have been focused on, like the prohibition on handing out bottled water and changing the times of voting and how long you have to apply for an absentee ballot, those are all things that add up together to making it more difficult for many people to vote. But those are things that one could quibble about and interpret in different ways. But there's no way to interpret this provision that allows for the suspension of local officials and then putting in someone who would then have the power to sabotage the certification of a voting outcome. If that part of the bill is extraordinarily dangerous. And had that been the law in November of this past year, there is no doubt, no sane person can for even one second imagine that the conservative, Republican, Trump cult faction in the state of Georgia would have implemented a provision like that, whether properly or legally or not. But one way or another, they would have implemented that provision in a way that would have made it impossible to have declared an official result to the Georgia election. And even more specifically, what they would have done is to have declared major election problems and taken over the election count in the counties because the law allows them to do it in no more than four counties in one election. And of course, those four counties in 2020 would have been Fulton County, DeKalb County, Clayton County, and one other, but it would have been the four counties that produced 40% of the vote for Joe Biden. And so there's just no doubt that is in the law specifically to give the ruling party in Georgia, and right now that's Republicans, but to give that ruling party a mechanism for chaos, for creating chaos and throwing an election in doubt. And that's explicitly what that is about. I don't think it means that democracy isn't working anymore, but what it does mean is that the Republican Party is being eclipsed in American life. All of the core trends of our society in terms of demographics and the political views of the American people are all trending away from the Republican Party and away from conservatism. That's why President Trump never had an approval rating higher than about 35% his entire presidency. And so the Republican Party, whether one likes it or not, likes its politics or not, the Republican Party is on the wrong side of the most powerful trend in our society, and so has chosen to gerrymander districts to get advantages that don't reflect the will of the people, and now to attempt new kinds of voter suppression or voter or election chaos that they believe will increase the possibility of them retaining power, even when it's clear that the will of the American people is no longer in support of them.
If you could predict the future, because, you know, Georgia is just the first state with those laws. We've got about 47 other states trying to put similar game plans in place. If those laws pass across the country, does that really mean that the American experiment is over?
No, because I don't think it does. It's an alarming thing, and it would be a terrible thing, but it's a thing that then will be undone. Because the American experiment wasn't over when the Jim Crow voter suppression and far worse than voter suppression, but when African Americans were almost 100% excluded from voting in states like Georgia, including at a time when African Americans were the majority of the citizens of Georgia. Now, that was the case right after the Civil War. And African Americans were the majority in Louisiana.
And South Carolina, all over the South, yeah.
Yeah, and so it was a similar situation in the sense that that what we would today call conservative white political leaders and their constituents saw that if the honest expression of the majority of the people is registered in the elections, well, we're going to be in a lot of trouble, particularly those of us who don't want anything good to happen for African Americans. And so that's where the Jim Crow voting restrictions came from. And so that's the way that the current law has clear overtones of Jim Crow. It uses totally different mechanisms and specific details, but this intention of making it likely that the election outcomes will be very different from the honest will of the people is what that's all about. But I think that if that does begin to happen, then the American experiment will do as it did before. It'll prevail. And that is that, again, people of goodwill will eventually mobilize in ways and find each other in ways, as they did in the 2020 election to defeat President Trump, as they did in 2018 to take back the House of Representatives. And I think that, it will be a struggle and it will be a battle. But I think that in the end, these kinds of things won't stand. There will be federal legislation that will help to get things back where they should be, of honest voting and honest, and where every voter can vote and their vote counts. I think that those things will eventually happen. And some of the things that people like former Attorney General Eric Holder, who I'm writing a book with right now, the work that he's doing on gerrymandering and fighting gerrymandering and election reforms, I think those things will ultimately work. But right now, we're in a dark period in which there are people trying to do very bad things, and good people have to stand up against them.
I hope the goodwill of the people will prevail. Douglas Blackman, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us this morning. And your book again is Slavery by Another Name, The Reenslavement of Black Americans from the Civil War to World War II. Thanks so much for that book, and thanks so much for sharing with us this morning.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.